Thanks everyone for coming. This is joint work with collaborators at the University of Washington, University of California, San Diego, and University of Minnesota. I'm going to start with a motivating example from a Google paper that appeared at IMC last year. They found that 20% of Google's client prefixes experienced highly inflated network latencies, even when there was a Google data center nearby. So they built a system to debug these problems. In this example, they found a set of clients and prefixes in Taiwan, shown in red up there, who are experiencing really poor network latencies of more than 500 milliseconds, even though Google has a data center nearby in Southeast Asia. So to give you some idea of what 500 milliseconds means, that's basically enough that it was as if the traffic was leaving the clients, circling the equator, and then going to Google. So the first thing that they looked at was whether or not the clients were actually being served by the nearby data center. Maybe they were actually being served by the data center in California, and then that could explain the inflation. They found that, in fact, they were being served by this nearby data center. The next thing that they looked at was maybe the path from the data center to the clients wasn't very direct. Maybe it was going, you know, something like this, and that could explain the inflation. But with Traceroute, they were able to verify that, in fact, there was a direct path from the data center to the clients. But most communication on the internet's two-way, including Google's, and most paths on the internet are asymmetric. So this means that the path from the data center to the clients is likely different from the path from the clients back to the data center. And all they know about that path back from the clients is that it leaves the clients, and then sometime later, it enters the data center. They really have almost no visibility into the reverse path. And so what they concluded was that in order to more precisely troubleshoot problems, Google needs the ability to gather information about the reverse path from the clients back to Google. In fact, this is a problem for more than just Google. In the past, I've built systems for geolocation, for monitoring internet outages, for predicting paths and performance on the internet. And all these techniques take measurements as their input, but we can only see one direction, and so the invisibility of the reverse path hurt our accuracy. With geolocation, we used trace routes to constrain the locations of routers, but the constraints were too loose because we only knew one direction. With Hubble, we were monitoring outages, but when the failures were on the reverse path, we really didn't know where they were. And with iPlane, we found that we could get much more accurate predictions if we had access to the reverse paths, but in the general case, we didn't have them. In fact, there's many systems that use sophisticated measurements, and they're often forced to assume symmetry, and they'd immediately benefit from an ability to measure the reverse path. I've listed a few systems up here on the slide, but really many systems that use Traceroute would benefit from the ability to gather reverse paths. So there's been this widespread problem affecting both operators and researchers. I have up there a quote from a NANOG tutorial on troubleshooting problems that I attended last year. They said that the number one go-to tool is Traceroute, but asymmetric paths are the number one plague of Traceroute, and that's because the reverse path itself is completely invisible. So you can get a good idea about a problem when it's on the forward path, but you're really flying blind if it's on the reverse path. This leads to our goal. We want a reverse traceroute that works without control of the destination and that's deployable today without any new support from the network or new functionality from routers. So this is our setting. I'm going to walk through and build up the system. We want to measure the path from D back to S. We control S and can install software there, but we don't control D. So relating this back to that Google example that I started with, S is the data center and D is the client. So one thing that we can do is issue a trace route from S to D, but the path's likely asymmetric, so this probably doesn't really tell us that much about the path from D back to S. Trace route works by limiting the time to live value on the packets to elicit error responses from the routers along the path, but we can't just use TTL limiting like trace route, and that's because the destination, which we don't control, is going to set the TTL to a normal value. So there won't even be errors, and then even if there were errors, they're going to go back to the destination, not to us, so we won't get them. Luckily, we do have access to vantage points around the world. Think of something like Planet Lab. These aren't going to directly give us the path from D, but we can use them to get a view that's unavailable from S, and we can combine them to get a better view than any of them will have on their own. So now what can we do with them? Well, the first thing we can do is just issue trace routes from all of them back to our source. This isn't going to give us the full path from D, but it gives us a baseline that we can build off of, and we just need to fill in that missing part. Internet routing is generally destination-based, and I should do a little aside here. The terminology is a bit confusing. So from the perspective of a packet on the reverse path, destination-based routing is routing towards S, not towards D. So when I talk about destination-based routing, I'm talking about routing towards S. Destination-based routing means that the next hop usually depends only on the destination, not on the source or the path so far. So that means that if we intersect one of these paths that we've measured, we can assume that the rest of our path there is the same. And actually, destination-based routing gives us something even better than that. It means that we can build back the path incrementally. So if we discover that the path from D to S goes through R1, we need to only determine the path from R1 back to S. We can ignore D. Destination-based routing doesn't always hold, but it works often enough that we can base our system around it. Like traceroute, we're going to end up with some caveats that the user needs to be aware of, but the results are still going to be useful. So then we can just continue piecing together the path incrementally using destination-based routing. Maybe next we discover it goes from R1 to R2 to R3. And now we just need to measure from R3 back. Say we discover that it goes through R4. And at this point, R4 is on the path from V1 to S. And so we're going to assume that we follow V1's path the rest of the way back to S. So we've now successfully combined to piece together the path incrementally until we get the whole way back. Of course, I left out a big part. I didn't tell you how you actually get any of the segments that you build. So we need something that's going to be able to tell us, maybe a few hops at a time, what IP addresses are along the path. And luckily, IP options can do that for us. So IP options are a built-in part of the internet protocol that you can enable on any packet. We're the first to use them to measure reverse hops. Unlike time to live, IP options are going to be reflected in the destination's reply to a ping, and so they'll work over both the forward path and the reverse path. The first IP option that we're going to use is the record route option. Record route allocates space for 9 IP addresses in the header of the packet, and then the first 9 routers along the path should fill out their IP addresses. If the destination's reached within 8 hops, then the remaining slots will be filled out on the reverse path. So let's say that our path looks like this, with F1 through F5 on the forward path, then the destination, and then R1 through R6 on the reverse path. Well, then record route will give us the first 9 hops of that, so the 5 hops along the forward path, the destination, and 3 hops along the reverse path. So this is great. If we're near enough to use record route, we're going to be able to get a hop, maybe 2 hops, in this case 3 hops. The problem is the average path in the internet is maybe about 15 hops in each direction, 30 hops round trip. So we need something to do if S isn't close to D. This is where we're going to use the fact that we have distributed vantage points. We're going to get around this limitation of 9 hops by using the ability of some vantage points to spoof probes. This means that they can send out packets with the source address of the packet set to something other than their own IP address. And what we're going to do is set the source to S. So in this case, let's say that we have a vantage point V3 that's close to D. It's going to send a record route ping to D, but it's going to spoof and claim that that packet came from S. When it gets to D, some number of the slots will be filled out, let's say 7 hops in this case. D will add itself in to the record route slots, and then it thinks the packet came from S, so it's going to reply back to S. When the packet gets to S, the last slot's been filled in, and we've discovered that R1 is on the reverse path from D. So we now have a way to measure a hop back from anywhere that's close to any of our vantage points. We now know the path goes like this, and using destination-based routing, we can iterate, find another vantage point that's near R1, and just measure back from R1. Let's say that V2 is near R1. We'll send the spoofed record route probe from V2, spoofing as S. When it gets back to S, we've discovered that R2 and R3 are on the reverse path, so it looks like this. Now, suppose that there's not a vantage point that's close to R3. We're not going to be able to use record route anymore, but we might still have some idea what the set of next possible hops are. In particular, there's systems like iPlane that measure lots of trace routes, and so we can inspect those trace routes and see what possibilities are for where the path might go from R3. So let's say that we've seen trace routes like this, maybe we've seen another trace route like this. Those are possibilities for where we might want to go. So it seems like R4 or R5 might be good guesses for where this path's going to go next. We now need a way, given one of these guesses, to verify if it's actually the hop on our path. We're going to use a different IP option for that. We're going to use the IP timestamp option. So the timestamp option lets you specify up to 4 IP addresses in the header of the packet, and then if those hops are traversed in order, they should fill out a timestamp. What we're going to do is have S send a timestamp probe to R3, asking first for R3's timestamp, then for R4's. Putting them in this order is going to force R4 to only stamp if R3 already has. So the packet gets here, R3 fills out a timestamp, it replies. When it gets back to the source, we see that there is a timestamp from R4, And so we can conclude that R4 is on the reverse path back from R3 because it's stamped after the packet reached the destination. So it's somewhere on the reverse path. We've observed it adjacent to R3 before, and so we're going to assume that it's the next hop. So now if we guess a hop, we have a way to verify if our guess was correct. At this point, we've intersected our traceroute atlas of paths back to S, and so we're going to assume that we follow V1's path to S, and we successfully stitch together the path the whole way back to the source. To go over the key ideas from the technique, first, it works without control of the destination. And we're going to get around the fact that we don't control the destination by using multiple vantage points. We're going to have them combine to get a view that's unavailable from any single one of them. We're able to stitch the path together hop by hop because of destination-based routing. And we use the fact that we have access to traceroute atlases to provide baseline paths back to the source that we can build off of, and also to provide adjacencies that give us hops to guess when we need to guess. We're then going to use IP options because they work over both the forward or reverse path, and the record route option lets us measure which hops are on it, and the timestamp option gives us a way to verify our guesses. Spoofing is going to let us use whichever vantage point's in the best location to make a particular measurement, and so we gain the power of all our vantage points. There's more details in the paper on how we can improve the accuracy, coverage, and scalability of the system. For instance, some routers process IP options in weird ways, so we have to account for that. Some ISPs might filter our probe packets, so we need ways to get around those filters. And then we have access to a bunch of vantage points, but we want our system to have low overhead, so we need intelligent ways of choosing which vantage point to use for any particular measurement. When none of our vantage points are able to measure a reverse hop from a particular point, we're forced to assume that that one hop is symmetric, and then we just measure from that symmetric hop back. So the coverage of our system is really tied to the set of spoofing vantage points that we have available. Currently, we're using vantage points from Planet Lab and Measurement Lab, and over time, about 90 of the sites have allowed spoofing. Right now, we have a closed system, so the sources are a subset of Planet Lab nodes, and you can access a demo to try those out at revtr.cs.washington.edu. In the future, we're going to recruit more vantage points to improve our coverage, and we're going to open up the system to outside sources so that you'll be able to install a bit of software on your machine and then measure the paths back to you. In the paper, we evaluate coverage and overhead. In the talk, I'm just going to talk about accuracy. So you'd like the tool to be equivalent to what you'd get if you actually had access to the destination and could just issue a direct trace route. Now, we lack ground truth of the internet as a whole, but we're going to be able to evaluate whether we can get this property in a controlled setting. And what we're going to do in the talk is look at paths between Planet Lab nodes. So I'm going to look at 2,200 paths between Planet Lab nodes. We're going to compare a direct traceroute, where we do control the destination, just log into it, issue a traceroute, to a reverse traceroute, where we're going to assume that we don't control the destination and use the techniques that I outlined in the talk. So this graph shows the result of that comparison. The x-axis is the fraction of hops on the direct traceroute that we also saw in our reverse traceroute. And as a baseline, I'm showing how many of the hops you'd get if you just assumed that the path was symmetric, which is what we've often had to resort to doing in the past. So that's the black line labeled guess forward. It's a CCDF. So to explain how to read it, maybe I'll just point out a point on the graph. So in the median case, if you assume that the path's symmetric, you get 38% of the hops that you'd see if you actually had access to the destination and could issue a traceroute from it. With our system, in the median case, you get 87% of the same hops. And so the benefit of our system is this shaded area here. Now, one thing is that it's hard to know if two hops are the same when we're comparing paths. So in fact, we might actually be doing even better than this. This is because traceroute generally is going to give you the incoming interface on any particular router, and recordRoute will often give you the outgoing one. So it's hard to know if these two IP addresses belong to the same router. We did borrow existing techniques for identifying which interfaces are on the same router, but they don't always work. And so in cases when we don't know if two IP addresses are the same, it's going to count as a miss in this graph. So some of the gap where we're not getting complete accuracy might just be that we don't know that the hops are the same. Essentially, this graph is conflating hops where we're wrong with hops where we're right, but we can't tell. And so what I'm going to try to do now is tease apart those two effects a little bit. To look at that, in addition to looking whether we got the correct router, we also assessed whether or not we got the right pop. And by a pop, I basically mean a given AS in a particular city, and we identified pops based on DNS names. So the blue line there shows our pop coverage. And we can see in the median case there, you get 100% of the pops that you would see if you had access to the destination and could directly issue a traceroute. Now, it's also possible that traceroute and reverse traceroute both see correct paths, but they're different due to things like load balancing. And in the paper, we discuss other reasons that they might differ. So we might not always get you 100% of the path. Sometimes we won't give you the whole thing, but the differences seem to mainly be alias identification issues and load balancing. I started out with a problem that Google was having with clients in Taiwan, and now we're going to walk through an example of how you could use our system to address a problem like that. So in this case, we measured a round-trip latency from a PlanetLab node in Florida to a network in Seattle of 150 milliseconds. And the destination happens to be in Seattle, but it's not affiliated with the University of Washington. It was sort of random that it happened to be there. So that latency is about two or three times what you'd expect. Something like 60 milliseconds, 80 milliseconds would be pretty reasonable. So with current practices, what you'd do if you controlled the node in Florida is you'd issue a traceroute to the destination and try to see if it was taking an indirect path. So that's what we did. So if you look at the path, you can see it's starting in Florida, going up to DC, coming back down from DC to Florida again, and then it's going from Florida across the country to Seattle. So there is this big detour from Florida down to DC, from Florida up to DC and then back down to Florida again. It's wasting about 50 milliseconds. But that doesn't explain the huge jump in latency from 50 milliseconds on the ninth hop to 150 milliseconds on the 10th hop. Also, if you look at the path, you'll see there's a big latency on hop 5. It might be another inflated reverse path, but because it's not continuing through to hop 6 and the other ones, it's not affecting our end-to-end round-trip time. So at this point, with traditional tools, you know part of the problem, but you don't know the full problem, and you only have a partial explanation of what's going on. So it seems like you know the reverse path's doing something silly, but you don't really know where it's going. With our tool, we're able to issue a reverse traceroute and measure that path from Washington back to Florida. So that's what we did. And you can see the path starts in Seattle, goes down to LA, goes from LA back to Seattle, and then it continues across the country through Chicago and Virginia. So this big detour down through LA is explaining the rest of the inflated round-trip time that we saw. So if you look a little closer at what ASs are involved, you see that it's traveling down to LA on InterNAP. It's crossing over from InterNAP to Transit Rail in LA, and then it's going back up on Transit Rail to Washington and then across the country. So it's not necessarily a misconfiguration. It could be that Transit Rail and InterNAP actually only peer down in LA, so it has to go down there. But we were able to verify with a trace route from University of Washington that they actually peer in Seattle as well. And actually, I was able to talk to operators from these ISPs and verify that this path was unintentional. So without both directions of the path, you have no way to understand what's going on in your round-trip path or who to contact to fix it. With access to this information, I, as a grad student, was even able to get in touch with people who could fix the path. I can now walk through an example of how you can use reverse traceroute to get better internet measurements for your systems. There are many systems that want access to backbone link latencies, and I've listed a couple examples of applications there. And the traditional approach for measuring these is to issue a traceroute from your source. And then if we're trying to measure the link AB, we're going to assume that the latency of AB is the round trip time to B minus the round trip time to A divided by 2. So that'll be a pretty good estimate if the reverse paths look like this and the paths traverse symmetrically. But if the path is actually asymmetric like this, you really have no idea what you're getting out. The first thing that we can do with reverse traceroute is detect which of these two cases we're in. So let's say that we're in this case, and the path is actually asymmetric. Now we know that the estimate for AB won't be very good. But if we issue a traceroute to C, maybe we see that these two links are traversed symmetrically, and so we can just divide the round-trip times and get good estimates for SA and SC. Reverse traceroute can actually do even better than that. We can build up a system of constraints on all the link latencies in our path, and then solve for all of them individually. And the way we'll do that is issue traceroutes and reverse traceroutes to all of the intermediate hops. And then for any particular measurement, we have a constraint that the round trip time has to equal the latency of all the forward links plus the latency of all the reverse links. If we throw in constraints from other measurements to other destinations or from other sources, we can get enough constraints to actually solve this system. So in this case, let's say we have another vantage point V. V issues the traceroute that looks like this. We can now solve for those two links because they're symmetric. So we now have VB and BC. And now if we look back at our original round-trip path, we have enough constraints on that system to solve for AB even though no individual path traversed AB symmetrically. So now solve for all the latencies. We assess the accuracy of this constraint-based technique on the Sprint topology because Sprint publishes inter-pop latencies on their website. So we compare to those latencies as the ground truth. There's 89 inter-pop links in their published topology. Reverse traceroute sees 79 of those links if we issue traceroutes and reverse traceroutes to all the pops. Traceroute sees only 61 of them, so the two lines have a different number of data points in them. The graph on the x-axis shows the error in our latency estimate compared to the ground truth published data. And it's a CDF, so it's showing the cumulative fraction of those links. So in the median, mean, and worst case, we do 10 times better than the traditional technique of just assuming symmetry and using traceroute. To give you some idea of what the relative errors might be like, the median link latency is 11.5 milliseconds. There's lots of links in the US that are around that value. And then the longest link in the Sprint topology is 97 milliseconds. That's Hong Kong to Stockholm. To conclude, traceroute's been a very useful tool, both for operators and for researchers, but it only shows you half the path. Our reverse traceroute system addresses this limitation. We can essentially give you the path that anyone uses to get to you. To develop the technique, we combine views from multiple vantage points, and we use destination-based routing to stitch together the path incrementally. We're able to give you most of the hops as if you issued a traceroute from the destination, even though you don't control it. I gave an example of how you can understand routing in a way that you couldn't before using reverse traceroute with that inflated path from Florida to Washington. I also gave an example of how you can get more accurate latency data to feed to other systems. We're going to use this system to enable more accurate troubleshooting. But we think that it's useful in a wide range of contexts, not just the ones that I gave. I think that in most settings where you think to use traceroute, it would be a useful addition. And we anticipate that others will use it for other applications. At the moment, we have a closed demo available at revtr.cs.washington.edu. But in the future, we're going to open up the system so that you can install our software and use our distributed system to measure reverse paths back to you. Thanks, and I'm happy to take questions.
Rodrigo Fonseca, Brown University. This is really clever, really cool work.
Thanks.
So back in 2005, we did some measurements on IP options across basically all pairs on Planet Lab. Mm-hmm. And we found that about 50% of the paths dropped packets with any IP options, even NOP options. So how do you explain you got such success? Or did the internet improve?
So the most complete study that I'm aware of IP option coverage is the Descartes paper at SIGCOM 2008. And I think they found a little bit higher coverage than you're reporting. But it's true that there will be places where there's not coverage. And so the ability of our system is going to differ a bit from network to network. There might be some blind spots. However, one advantage that we have is, first of all, we can use spoofing to get around some of those filters. So we might have a vantage point that has a path to the destination that doesn't go through a filtering network, and we can avoid it that way. Another thing is that we're using this atlas of traceroutes to sort of bootstrap our paths. And so in many cases, we have good coverage of the backbone just using traceroutes that we can intersect. And so you really just need to get a couple hops so you know which direction you're going so you can intersect one of those paths and then follow it the rest of the way back. But it's certainly true there's going to be networks where we're going to be blind.
Hi, this is very cool, but I was wondering if you have considered evaluating a system with like the public traceroute servers where you could have them.
We have an evaluation using public traceroute servers in the paper. I presented the one using Planet Lab here mainly because we have better alias analysis there because the alias data sets that we're borrowing from other groups tend to use Planet Lab. But there's a similar study, and the results are very similar using public traceroute servers.
Do you have any quantitative results you could like give us in one sentence or two?
The lines look almost identical. It's 70-something coverage instead of 80-something. It's very similar.
Thank you.
We actually have time for some more questions. So I have one question for Ethan, actually. So this is really, really interesting stuff. And one thing that occurred to me is you're collecting kind of a lot of auxiliary information by trace routing from a bunch of probing from a bunch of different places and then stitching things together. I'm wondering if you thought about how to maybe reduce the overhead of this by looking, maybe storing some of that in advance or reusing it, or basically taking advantage of things that don't change maybe as often, so that you can just like run the run a reverse tracer almost like you would run a forward one.
So it's a really good idea. In the tracer atlas that we're intersecting, we do store that information around, and then when you intersect a stale path, you can just refresh that one path at the time and make sure that it's still the same, and then follow it. At the moment, we're not caching information about... So we do map which vantage points are close to which prefixes and use those for our spoofed record route probes. We don't cache some of the timestamp information, but a lot of it we do cache and then just refresh that path that cuts down on the overhead. There are some groups right now that are doing work on figuring out which parts of the internet change a lot and which don't, and I think it would be great for us to leverage some of that in the future.
Yeah, very nice. Didn't want to let the award winner get off too easily there. Okay. Congrats to Ethan and his co-authors, and thanks very much. Let's thank him again.